Ezekiel chapter 1 is where we pick things up tonight. We can continue our journey through the Bible. Ezekiel is a very interesting book. For those of you who were here last week and you took me up on the invitation to read the first three chapters, chapter 1 might have left you a bit baffled. You can see why when we give away free Bibles to new believers that we mark the gospel according to John and not Ezekiel. If they're coming in off drugs or something, the Lord's delivered them and they hit Ezekiel chapter 1, they won't know what in the world happened, you know. So it's an interesting book. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God, Ezekiel said. And on the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. The book of Ezekiel is named, as we see here, after the prophet that it chronicles, and the author of the book, and that was a prophet by the name of Ezekiel. His name means God strengthens, and God strengthened him, as we'll see tonight as we head into the chapters, and he needed the strengthening for what God had called him to. His father was a priest. That meant that he was of the lineage of the priests. And if it weren't for the fact that he had gone into captivity with his people, then at the age of 30 he would have become a priest among his people. But for sure Ezekiel had been trained, it would seem, to be a priest and to fulfill that responsibility as a priest while in Jerusalem before the Jews went into captivity. Ezekiel was taken captive in the second conquering of the Babylonians of the city of Jerusalem. As we saw going through the book of Jeremiah, the Babylonians were forced to conquer Jerusalem three times. And each time they did, they were just a little madder. By the time they conquered it a third time, they said, that's it, we're not going to come back and conquer it again, and we'll make sure we won't leave a city. And they didn't leave a city behind them. I mean, they just leveled temple, city, walls, everything. In 605 B.C., that was the first year that the Babylonians took the city of Jerusalem. And they took it, and what they did in conquering it was they took the cream of the crop. They took the most valuable thing that any country has, the best of its people. We think the most valuable thing that we have is money or infrastructure or any of that kind of thing. We've lost sight very much today. The most valuable thing about any people, any nation, is its people. And so the Babylonians, they knew the truth of it. Mere pagans, but they knew the truth of that. And so they went in and they took the best. And Daniel was taken in that captivity. He was a part of the cream of the crop. And Daniel was a contemporary of Ezekiel. And Daniel served the Lord in Babylon, in the palace and the great city of Babylon, served the Lord there. That was God's call for Daniel. And Ezekiel was taken captive a little bit later, and his ministry was among the captives of the Jews in Tel Aviv on the river Chebar, which was just not a river at all. It was just a canal that kind of fed off of the river Euphrates that fed a particular area of the Babylonian Empire. It irrigated that area of the Babylonian Empire, and the Jews had been placed there as essentially labor for providing the food supplies for the Babylonians. But in that year 605 was the first captivity. 8 years later, Nebuchadnezzar was forced to take the city again. And in 597, he took it a second time, and in that second taking of the captives, that's when he took Ezekiel, and took Ezekiel to Babylon. It would be 11 years later before the city of Babylon would fall the third time, which we went through with Jeremiah and then also in Lamentations. So both of these men are contemporaries of Jeremiah. And without a doubt, they were raised on Jeremiah's prophecies. They had heard what he was saying in the city. They knew what it was that he was prophesying. Daniel for sure knew the prophecies of Jeremiah, because after 70 years, he seeks the Lord based upon those prophecies. And so Daniel and Ezekiel were probably much younger than Jeremiah, but all of their lives overlapped in terms of time. Ezekiel was probably, as we see there in verse 1, he was probably taken captive at 25 years of age, and he was in captivity for 5 years, we're told here in these first three verses, when God came and gave him his first vision and called him into the ministry. And so he comes and begins all of these things that he's describing here at 30 years of age. I love the Lord for it. I love the Lord for it. Here's a man who perhaps, in the midst of all of the apostasy of Jerusalem, is a righteous young man. And at 25 years of age, 5 years before he gets to be a priest to his people, the dream of his life, he's taken captive to Babylon. No hope of being a priest at all now. And God waits 5 years until the man's 30 years of age, when he would have been called into the service to the Lord there at the temple, and he calls him into service in Babylon unto him anyway. I'm not through with you. I'm not through with you. We don't need a temple. We don't need a city to get my work done. I'm going to call you to serve me right where I've got you. And surely Ezekiel thought, this is it. All those hopes that I had for my life, all those hopes for what the Lord might do, all of those are out the window. And they weren't. But he was going to serve the Lord in a little different atmosphere. Now, Ezekiel was called to minister to the Jewish exiles to Babylon. Jeremiah continued to prophesy to the Jews in Jerusalem, and all these Jews that had been taken captive to Babylon, God raised up Ezekiel to be a prophet to them there in that city. And so that's who his ministry was these Jewish exiles. Now, sometimes we talk about the Jewish captives, and that's an okay word, but probably exile is the better word, because they had enormous freedom in Babylon. They weren't kept in cages and kept in ghettos or kept in, you know, small areas. They were free to roam. They became very prosperous under Babylonian rule, but they were exiles. They were not free to return back to the land until later. Now, even though these Jews were in their exile there in Babylon, they still hadn't come face to face with the reason for the fact that they had been brought into captivity or taken into exile. And so God raises up Ezekiel to confront them with their rebellion. They were rebellious people. Do you know that it's possible to bear the full consequences of our sin, to be taken captive to another land, to lose every single thing in our life because of our rebellion to God, and still remain a rebel, and still remain a rebel in heart? And that's what they were. The rebelliousness against God had not been removed, even though they had, were going to come to admit that God was right. That rebellion was there. I remember several years ago, I listened to a pastor at a men's conference. And this is an aside. And have this continual stream of couples, married couples, coming in for counseling. And the man was typically the problem, and treating the woman like dirt, just treating her like just like trash, and so rude, so selfish, so I mean, just treating her like this object. And he said, one day a light went on for him in one of those counseling sessions, and he looked at the man. And he looked at the woman, and he said, were you two sexually active before you got married? And they had been. And he began to ask these couples that were always in this turmoil, whether they had been, whether they knew the Lord at the time, or whether they didn't know the Lord at the time, or whatever. And he asked them, did you guys, before you ever got married, were you physically intimate with one another? And so often it was the pattern that that was the case. And what he ended up doing and thought was so important for the men to do was to confess that sin to their wife. Because they had begun the relationship treating her like an object. An object that had been provided for their gratification. And they then carried that on into the marriage and continued to treat her in that way. And here's a classic example of, yes, I confess, I admit that what I did was wrong. Yes, I'm dealing with the consequences of what I did was wrong, but I've never dealt with the rebellion in my heart. That was rebellion against God. That was sin against her. And I've never confessed my sin in that and never come face to face with that so that I could move from it. It's possible to face the full consequences of my rebellion and remain a rebel because there's no brokenness over it. And so God raised up this prophet now to confront them with their sin. Though you think, why would they need to be confronted with it? I mean, they're confronted with the consequences all of the time. But that doesn't have anything to do with the heart. The heart needed to be broken. And he raised up this prophet to break their hearts. And then, once their hearts were broken, then he raised up Ezekiel to be an encouragement to them. And the old saying concerning preachers is that they're there to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And if that's not true of any other preacher, it's true of Ezekiel. He afflicted the comfortable there in Babylon of those exiles. And then when Jerusalem went up in smoke 6 years later, and now all of a sudden all of their hope goes out the window apart from God. All their false prophets have been proved to be liars and all of that kind of stuff. And now they hit rock bottom. And the beautiful thing, that ministry of God's Holy Spirit upon Ezekiel's life, is he now anoints him now and says, they don't need to be afflicted anymore. They're all the way down now. I've got their attention now. He says, now they need comfort. And he became a comforter to those people. And so the ministry of Ezekiel was one of confronting these people with their rebellion that they still had not come face to face with fully, and then to encourage them later when all hope seemed to have been gone. Ezekiel appeared to live in a tell known as Tel Abib. And a tell was just ancient cities piled upon another where they would build another city upon the ancient site of an old city. So it became kind of a mound. And here he is. Nobody knows quite where Tel Abib is in relationship to of Babylon. The commentators, some of them say, well, it was 5 miles away from the city of Babylon. Others say it was 50 miles away. Nobody really knows. But it sat on this river Chebar, this canal, and they were probably, you know, again, that labor for raising the produce for the Babylonians. And so this is what the kind of situation that Ezekiel found himself called into in the midst of as he began his ministry. He gets his first vision here in verse 4. And this is a wild vision. I had placed in your seat pockets in front of you just something to help us start to get bearings on this. This is from Bill McDonald's commentary, and it may or may not be perfect, but it gives us a reference point to start from. And actually, it seems to be pretty good, as you'll see as we head through. And so here he says, "Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire." The first thing he sees is this huge whirlwind that's going on in front of him. It's coming out of the north. Later on, I think it's in chapter 33, we'll see that it's described really as God's judgment coming forth. The Babylonians came down upon Jerusalem from the north, and the Babylonians were not operating independent of God. God was at work there through them. And so he sees now, 6 years before the final fall of Jerusalem, this judgment or this vision coming out of the north, and it represents the Lord coming forth from the north. He talks about the raging fire engulfing itself. And the image that is, excuse me, is of a rolling flame. You ever watch those old shows and they'll do like the atomic blasts, and the flame just it just rolls out over and over and over on top of itself. That's what he's seeing, this thing just getting bigger and bigger and growing out of itself, this huge flame that's coming forth. And it's a picture of God, really. The writer of the book of Hebrews says that our God is a consuming fire. John wrote in his epistle, and he said, "This is the message that we have heard from him and declare to you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all." And the apostle Paul was on that road to Damascus to arrest the Christians there in Damascus. He was knocked off of his high horse there and humbled. And the Lord, and he describes that situation as being at midday. He saw this light from heaven that was brighter than the sun shining all around him. And then the Lord, of course, spoke to him and said, "Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" And so the Lord here, this light and all coming out. And the light is one of, the color of it is amber. That is that brownish, yellow, kind of an awesome thing. Now, one of the things about visions is that basically a vision is, and certainly this vision is just God giving Ezekiel a glimpse into the eternal, into the realm that he couldn't see. Here's Ezekiel. He's sitting there at Tel Abib, and he's in this just dusty old place there in Babylon. All he can see is what's going on around him. And God says to Ezekiel, "Let me show you what's really going on around you. Let me show you what's really going on in this on the earth." And basically what this vision is of a chariot throne of God. And in those days when they used to move the kings from one place to another, they would be on this, they'd have their throne up on this giant chariot that had been built for that purpose. And God is showing him this vision of this chariot throne that's far above all of the things that are happening in the world. And it's speaking of God's sovereignty. He has complete control over the world. And Ezekiel needed a glimpse of the eternal. You ever find you need a glimpse of the eternal? We certainly do need it to read the newspaper or to follow the news or any of that kind of stuff. And it's so easy to get bogged down on the temporal, get all steamed at all the things that are happening around. And how come they can't see this? And how come they don't do this? And all this kind of stuff. And then we say the solution is for the whole world to become, for me to be elected the grand poobah of the world and set it all straight. And that, believe me, that would not be the solution. The solution is is to see the Lord's throne above everything in this world. Fresh vision of Him. A glimpse of Him. And that's what God gives to Ezekiel here. And so, here he sees this great whirlwind and the fire engulfing itself coming out of it. And then in verse 5, he sees these four living creatures. And also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. He's going to describe these living creatures to us. And they're angels. He's describing angels here. And sometimes people say, well, you know, I'd like to see an angel. And maybe you wouldn't. Maybe you wouldn't. Maybe your heart couldn't take it. You read in the book of Revelation, it talks about these angels, 1 foot on the sea, 1 foot in the ocean. They're huge. I mean, awesome, these angelic beings. And angels are described in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. It's filled with angelic activity. And angels are just creations of the Lord. But they're very, very interesting creations. We might even call them a little bit weird. In terms of how we would look at them. Each one of these angels, these four living creatures, each one of them, verse 6, had four faces. That's weird to begin with. You've only got one. And that's tough enough for a lot of us. If you had four, you know, be handy though as a parent. Huh? I tell you. At least the second one on the back side of the old head, or maybe as a school teacher, wouldn't that be handy? Yeah, we'd have been caught doing a lot of things if the old teacher had a second face back there. And so here they are, they have these four faces, and each one of them had four faces, each one had four wings, and their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. So here he describes their legs, no knees, no joints there. That's kind of weird, isn't it? And then they had feet, and their feet were hooves. They were calves' feet. And they sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The color of the hooves there were like polished bronze. And they had the hands of a man under their wings. And they're four sides. So they got this big wing over here, and got a little hand under there, like this. And it's pretty weird. Hey, listen. If there's life on other planets, you look weird to them. You look weird. I mean, if they sent a photo of you to some other planet, if there was life there, said, look at these. They got two eyes right there. I can't believe. They got dopey these. So God has His creation, and He makes these angels. They're weird to us, but they seem to have high self-esteem. They're very happy with the way that they are. Maybe they've been to California schools, apparently. So they got these little hands under their wings. That one preacher in Pride and Prejudice. You've seen that. At any rate, their wings touched one another, and the creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. So you see on the drawing that you have there, apparently each one of them have a corner. And with one set of their wings straight out and touching one another. And we see in the book of Revelations very much a picture that's described in Revelation 4 and 5. We see angels that are very similar to this. I'm not saying they're the same angels, because there are differences. And these angels are wing to wing. And the idea is of protection around the throne. And these angels are around that throne in that capacity. So their wings touched one another, and they went straight forward. And so when that chariot would move, because they had these different faces, four different faces, which we'll get to in just a moment. When you have a face on each side of your head, you don't have to move to go in another direction. And so when they were going in one direction, everyone was going forward because they all had a face in that direction. And then if they went in another direction, It was all moving forward. Nobody was troubled by that. They all had a face going in that direction. And so there wasn't like things having to turn around in order to move. They just, when they went, wanted to go this way, and it this way, and it stopped. They wanted to go this way, then they went this way, and they stopped. This may be of no interest to you, but this is fascinating to me. There's a ride for you at Great America. The four living creature ride. Now, in verse 10, as for the likeness of their faces, each one of them had a face of a man. So the face of a man there. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of them had a lion's face on the right side. Each of the four had a face of an ox on the left side. I mean, God does things decently in an order. There's a uniformity here. And each of the four had the face of an eagle, and thus were their faces. And so those were the faces that they had, a face of a man, face of a lion, face of an ox, face of an eagle. And in this, as has been noted by many, you have a picture of the four Gospels here. You have Matthew's Gospel, which brings forth Jesus as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. You have Mark's Gospel. The theme is that Jesus was the servant, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. What animal most symbolizes service for the master? Well, it's an ox. And then you have the Gospel according to Luke, which emphasizes the humanity of Jesus. And then you have the which is symbolized by the man. And then John's Gospel speaks of the deity of Jesus represented by the eagle. And so, you know, all of these, everything testifies of the Lord, and however far you want to take those things, but there is an interesting shadow as it relates to all of that. Now, one of the things that's important to notice concerning all of this is that Ezekiel, through all of this, he uses this term, as you see it in verse 5, and from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And so Ezekiel's coming and he's saying, now this, they're kind of like this. And I haven't seen anything like this before. I never saw anything like this in Jerusalem. I haven't seen anything at Tel Aviv that looks anything like this. And so he's trying to find a point of reference, a common denominator to communicate with us and with the people to say, this is kind of what they look like. And it's not easy to do. Let's say there never was an elephant on the planet, in the history of mankind. All of a sudden you see an elephant. And you have no pictures of it or anything, and now you've got forced to describe an elephant to someone who's never seen an elephant. You say, well, you know, their nose is kind of like, you'd have to find some basis of comparison. You say, their legs are kind of like this. Their skin is kind of like this. Their ears are kind of like this. And he's trying to get as close a likeness as he can, in trying to describe them, but we understand from it that he's just kind of doing the best that he can. And their wings, we're told in verse 11, were stretched upward, and two wings of each one touched one another, and two wings covered their body. So as you see in the drawing, two of them went out like this, and then the other set of wings went down by their side, just kind of a modesty around the throne of God. And each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. And so this is, now you've got Ezekiel repeating himself on this, but when you see this kind of stuff, you repeat yourself. And he describes the fact that their movement was directed by God's Spirit. They weren't just doing what they wanted. And as for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of torches. Fire was going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning, and the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance as a flash of lightning. And now I looked at the living creatures. As I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth. So now he sees these living creatures, and now he sees wheels in this vision. And the appearance of the wheels and their works was like the color of beryl, which is a kind of a green yellowish glow, and all four had the same likeness. The wheels all looked the same, and the appearance of the wheels was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of the wheel. And so here he looks at these creatures, and his focus now, he's kind of gotten over them a little bit. Now he looks at the wheels associated with his chariot now. It's got, remember, it's a throne chariot. And he sees these wheels, and the thing that he notices about the wheels, first of all, there in verse 15, is that they touch the ground. That this throne and what's going on here, it is in contact with the ground. It's linked to the earth. And then he sees, in verse 16, he sees a wheel in the middle of a wheel. And the idea seems to be that one wheel was kind of going in this direction, and then there was a wheel within it that went, cut it at nine, kind of a 90-degree angle, kind of like what's in the drawing. So again, as they would go in any direction, the wheel was ready to move in that direction. And so there was a wheel within in the wheel. And then, verse 17, when they went toward any one of four directions, and they did not turn aside when they went. And as for their rims, the rims of these wheels, they were so high, they were awesome. Now, one of the things about mankind is we're deeply impressed with what? Size. Size. These people, I mean, someone builds this size of a building, you know, and then the next dictator, he's got to build something twice as big as that. And so there's this great impression over size. And Ezekiel says, hey, you know, to mankind, forget anything you've seen. Forget anything you've built. Nothing we can do here compares with the glory of this unseen realm that goes on all day and night around us that for the most part we're not aware of. And so building these monuments to ourselves is silliness in light of what, you know, God is riding around in. And so they're awesome. And the rims of these wheels were full of eyes around the four of them. So that's weird, isn't it? Got this wheel. You got the wheel within the wheel. And then there's eyes all around the rim. And it has to be speaking of the fact that God is, because the wheels touch the ground, so God is aware of everything that's happening on the earth. He's conscious of everything. Ezekiel probably thought, God, do you know what's going on down here? You know we're in Babylon. Do you know what's happening? Should I, you know, write you? Should I email you? What? How do I have that? And God is just speaking here through this vision. I know everything that's going on. I know everything that's going on the earth. There's nothing that isn't noticed by me. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. And wherever the Spirit wanted to go, they went. And the wheels were under the control of God's Spirit, because there the Spirit went, and the wheels were lifted up together with them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. And when those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. And so that's his description of these living creatures, the whirlwind, the wheels, and all. And now he begins to talk about what was above all of these angels. And so the idea here, as you look at the drawing, is that you've got this firmament that he talks about in the next couple of verses. And the firmament, we think of firmament as being like, you know, terra firma. We talk about a ground or something like that. The word firmament just means a vast expanse, and it's talking about the expanse of heaven. And it's crystal, we're told, both here and in the book of Revelation. But now he's going to move and see vision above that firmament. In other words, he's going to take a look, he's going to get a vision of the glory of God. This was staggering enough for him living on earth to see the creation, to see the creation of the angels all here below. Things that are going on that we don't see, you know, and staggering things going on all around us. And he says, wow, there was something even more awesome than this, and that is the God who is on the throne that was above even this awesome creation. So that's what he begins to talk about. Let me just erase my work here. The likeness of the firmament above the heads of the living creatures. So now he's moving above those angelic beings, was like the color of an awesome crystal stretched out over their heads. And under the firmament, their wings spread out straight, one toward one another. Each one had two which covered a side, and each one had two which covered the other side of which had covered, let's see, each one had two which covered one side, and each one had two which covered the other side of the body. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of mighty waters, like the voice of the Almighty, a tumult, like the noise of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. And a voice came from above the firmament that was over their heads. Whenever they stood, they let down their wings. And so the description of the angels, and now above the firmament, over their heads, was the likeness of a throne. And here's the throne of God. An appearance like a sapphire stone. On the likeness of the throne was, on the likeness of the throne was a likeness with the appearance of a man high above it, and perhaps a theophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ there in the Old Testament. And also from the appearance of his waist upward, now as Ezekiel begins to describe the one related to the throne, I saw, as it were, the color of amber and the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and downward, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire with brightness all around, like the appearance of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day. So was the appearance of the brightness all around it, that is the throne. And this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And so here's this brightness, all of this going on around the throne, all of the colors surrounded by the colors of the rainbow. Again, this is very much described in Revelation chapter 4, when John receives his vision there of heaven. And so we notice here that the throne is above everything. It's above everything. All of the creation. It's even above the angelic beings. And the picture is that the throne of God is above everything else. And what God was giving Ezekiel was, he was giving him a vision, not of God, he was giving him supremely a vision of the glory of God. The glory of God. Before he ever wanted him to speak a word for him, he wanted him to have a vision of his glory. And so that's what chapter 1 is a vision of the glory of God. And that God is moving, God is active, God is on his throne is mobile, he's marching. He's moving forward in his ideas, his goals, what he's going to do. And even though it looks like nothing is happening there. And so that's the picture that's given there to Ezekiel, the government of God over everything else. And so when I saw it, he said in end of verse 28, I fell on my face and I heard a voice of one speaking. And so the thing that he did here is he sees this whole thing, and his response is that he falls on his face. Again, you get to, sometimes you witness the people and they say, well, you know, if God is real, then why doesn't he just show up right here? Because you'd be a little pile of ash, buddy, if he did that. And so here is Ezekiel. He had to be, you know, especially prepared to handle this. Remember in Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah had his vision of the Lord in the year that King Uzziah died. I saw the Lord high and lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple, and as he spoke about the angels crying out, holy, 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 and all, the response, and it wasn't like Isaiah said, let's see, this would be a good place to fall down. It was this, like, he just went right down before the Lord. Same thing with John in Revelation chapter 1, as he's taken up into that heavenly scene, sees all that's going on, and immediately he falls down. It's kind of like the scarecrow before Oz, you know. It just can't even get his feet up. It's just the awesomeness of the whole scene. Boom, goes down in the presence of the Lord. I think it's important to have a very intimate, and a very friendly, and a very personal and wonderful relationship with the Lord. But there are lines where it can get too casual. And I never like to hear God spoken of as that big fella in the sky, you know. And in the Westerns, they all talk about them in kind of that vein. Well, you know, the big fellow just got ha, 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 ha. And they kind of talk about that whole deal. And, you know, sometimes you have to be careful about that as it relates to the Lord. The Lord, who He is, I mean, what He's created is unbelievably awesome. And that just speaks of the Lord's existence. It doesn't even speak of the glory that's there for Him. And so here is Ezekiel. He's down on his face. God commissions him now into ministry in chapter 2. And then the Lord said to Ezekiel, "Son of man, stand on your feet and I'll speak to you." And Ezekiel probably thinking, "I'd love to stand on my feet, but I'm a little overwhelmed at the moment." God says, "I have a solution to that." Verse 2, "Then the Spirit entered me when He spoke to me and set me on my feet, and I heard Him who spoke to me. And He said to me, 'Son of man, I'm sending you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day.'" And so God gives Ezekiel the job description. "This is where I'm going to send you. I'm going to send you to minister to a bunch of rebels who claim, you know, to know me, and I want you to talk to them, for they are impudent and stubborn people." And the idea is there is that they're stiff-faced. In other words, it's just they're rebellious, they're stubborn, and they're rebellious against the Lord. And that's describing His people. And that's nice. So God comes to him and says, "Now listen, this is what you're going to spend the next 22 years of your life doing. You're going to be talking to rebellious people of mine." And God is pretty fair throughout the Bible in kind of telling people about what they're getting into. You remember when Paul was called after his meeting with the Lord there on the road to Damascus and the vision and all of that that happened to him. And the Lord went to Ananias and said, "Ananias, I want you to go to this guy by the name of Saul, and I want you to lay hands on him, pray for him, all of this. He's over here, he's been blinded," and all the things the Lord tells him. Ananias says, in effect, "Listen, won't he do a little less damage blind? You know, we've been hearing about this guy for a long time." And the Lord said, "No, I've called him to serve me, and right now I'm telling him the things that he has to suffer for my name's sake." And the Lord just put it out before him, the things that he was, the price that he was going to pay to serve the Lord. I don't know that there could be a more difficult and a more frustrating ministry that anyone could be called to than the one that was Ezekiel was called to, and that is dealing with those who claim to know the Lord and yet live day in and day out in rebellion to His Word. And that can be a taxing experience when you run into that kind of person periodically, to be the makeup of the entirety of the congregation. That's a rough call. He said in verse 4, "I'm sending you to them, and you shall say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God.'" In other words, Ezekiel, here's what I want you to do. I want you to speak for me. Say, "Thus says the Lord." Now that's what a prophet was. A prophet was one who spoke for God. "And as for them," I want you to speak for me, "but as for them, whether they hear or whether they refuse, for they're a rebellious house, yet they will know that a prophet has been in their midst," in the Old King James, "or among them," in the New King James. And I like that. God speaks to Ezekiel, and He says, "Ezekiel, you speak for me, but it's not your problem whether they listen to you or not. That is not your deal. That's not what you have to worry yourself about. You be faithful to me. You leave the results to me." Don't worry about how the message is responded to. And then I love this. I've always loved this verse 5 at the end there. "Yet they will know that a prophet has been in their midst." And that's all the Lord wanted, was a prophet to be in their midst. And basically it would hold them responsible for their lives. So that later on they couldn't complain and say, "Well, gosh, God, you never told us, or we never knew, or we had no idea." And God said, "You had a prophet in your midst the whole time." And that's what God wants us to be on our jobs, the places that He puts us. It is not under our control whether people listen to what we have to say or whether they accept what we have to say and what the Bible has to say. But we are called to deliver the message that God gives us to deliver, and so that they will know when the day comes, and the day will come, that someone spoke to them accurately and correctly about the Lord. I was reading Newsweek this last week, and they have this conventional wisdom column in there. They kind of do this little arrow thing about, you know, who's on the upscale, who's on the downscale, and all this kind of stuff. And then they have an arrow side by side if it's kind of a wash. And they had Governor George Bush Jr., governor of Texas, on there. And in recent weeks, he had been getting the up arrow. This guy's the up-and-rising political star in the United States. And this last week, they gave him a horizontal arrow. And the reason they gave him a horizontal arrow is apparently somewhere it leaked out, I guess he's a believer, that he believes that only Christians go to heaven. Well, I guess this is a flash for Newsweek. It tells me they're not employing Christians on a rather heavy level. This is no secret in the Bible that there is a way of salvation that's been provided through the Messiah that God had promised His Son, the Lord Jesus, and the way to be saved and to be forgiven is through belief in His salvation and in His Son. And so now he's kind of in the outs because nobody knows what kind of damage that's going to do to him politically. Whether a person can be elected as the President of the United States of America in the year 2000, believing that there's one way to get to heaven and that there's one salvation. He's in a tough spot. He held office for 4 years, or for holding it for 8 years. How far into eternity do you think we'll be before we forget about the White House? I have a hunch it'd be pretty quick. I'm trying to forget about it on a daily basis myself. Already, this side of glory. You know, so you have to bring the fumigators in and the whole thing for the year 2000 anyway. But anyway, that was my comment. That wasn't in the Bible. I just want you to know. But all this other stuff in a moment is going to be gone. But the thing that's going to last is we make a stand for the things of the Lord and the truth of the Lord, and then people will know that there was a prophet in their midst. There was someone who was telling us the truth in our lives. And that's what God wanted. And He said, "And you, son of man, do not be afraid of them, nor be afraid of their words, though briars and thorns are with you," though they whip you with this stuff, "and you dwell among the scorpions, and they put you out in the desert. Do not be afraid of their words or dismayed by their looks." And that said to me, in other words, why would he tell them this? Because he's going to be afraid. And the best of us are afraid in different environments. Paul was afraid in Corinth. The Lord came to Paul by night and said, "Don't be afraid." Why would he say that? Because he was afraid. Jesus isn't like a chatty Cathy. Comes in and says, "Don't be afraid," for no reason. We should be a doll called that. I don't know personally about anyone. I didn't have a word. And so, he was afraid. He was afraid related to this. And the Lord said to him, "Don't be afraid. I've got a lot of people in this city that I'm going to reach, and I'm going to reach them through you." But we do face fear. And Paul faced fear. But he said, "Listen, don't worry about that. Don't be afraid no matter what they do to you. Don't be afraid of their words." And you know the old saying, "Sticks and stones break my bones, but word will never hurt me." That's a person that lived in a bubble that wrote that. Words hurt a lot. And then he said, "Don't be afraid of their looks." And looks can hurt a lot. Or be dismayed by their looks, though they are a rebellious house. "For you shall speak my words to them, whether they hear or whether they refuse, for they are rebellious. But you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Do not be rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give to you." And so God calls them here now not to be afraid to be a prophet in the middle of them. And then he warns, now listen, don't become rebellious against me by not speaking my word, because now you're on a par with them. And he said, "Now open your mouth and eat what I give to you." And then Now when I looked, Ezekiel said, there was a hand stretched out to me, and behold, a scroll of a book was in it. And of course, there are scrolls in those days. What, they didn't have books like at Barnes and Noble's or some other place. They had everything was written out on a scroll on papyrus, and they would roll it up on these rolls. And here's this scroll of a book. It was spread before Ezekiel, and there was writing on the inside and on the outside. It was written on both sides, which was very unusual for a scroll. Most of the time, they were only written on one side, and written on it were lamentations and mourning and woe. That was the message that he was going to bring to these people. Lamentations and mourning and woe.